Hello, everyone. Welcome to SIBO SOS, our very special masterclass in Q&A with Dr. Mark Pimentel. Dr. Pimentel is the head of the MAST, executive director of MAST at Cedars-Sinai. So that stands for Medically Associated Science and Technology. What does that mean, Dr. Pimentel? Hello, good morning.
Good morning. I'm so glad to be here. What it means is it's a program that I helped start up at Cedars-Sinai to develop new technologies for patients. One of the things that I sometimes get a little frustrated with is that pharmaceutical companies develop things in a certain way and not always patient-centered, in the sense that as a doctor, I know what patients need because I see thousands of them and I know exactly the kind of niche of things they need. And so I felt like maybe we could develop the things for SIBO and for IBS that we felt the patients were missing. And so we help develop those things and try to get them to patients eventually with this, my lab, with the clinical research, with our whole specialized team. 16 people working all for your audience.
Well, we appreciate it. We know it's a labor of love for all of you and a mission. And we're going to be talking about that mission of helping to get everybody cured of post-infectious IBS and SIBO. Go Team Raw! So you guys, if you know anybody really rich who wants to contribute to the cause, just a suggestion, I'm sure it's nonprofit. So, all right. Anyway, point made. Dr. Pimentel, I know you have an incredible presentation for us. Guys, Karen and Mariel are in the chat. Let me confirm that I have it turned on. It is. And if you want to pop into the Q&A box with a hello and where you're from, that'd be great. We aren't taking live questions today because we had so many pre-submitted, and we will, Karen and Mariel are in there to help you with customer service. Okay, go ahead and take it away, Dr. Pimentel.
Okay, so I'm gonna just share my screen so that you can see what's going on, and here we go. So let's see if I put that full screen, there we go. So as Siobhan mentioned, I'm here to give you a SIBO update. So some of the stuff you're going to see here is old because I have to give you a background for those who've never heard me speak or never heard the information. Also, there's going to be a lot of new stuff here. Siobhan says, promise me new stuff, and I promise new stuff, and I've got new stuff here. More to give you some really strong and very, very clear insights that we're on the hunt for this. We're close, and I want to leave you with optimism on how we might proceed. But I know this drives people crazy. Maybe it drives me crazy sometimes, but it's very tricky to separate irritable bowel syndrome and SIBO and to understand how the two of those things blend together. But SIBO affects 40 million people in the US, nearly 1 billion worldwide. So basically, there's a billion people in the world with SIBO. That makes it the most expensive disorder in gastroenterology because of so many people who have this. And also, think about it, these patients get tremendous testing. I always use this example, and if you've heard me say it, I'm not going to apologize because I want to spread the word about this. But I had a patient, and this is not unusual, maybe not to this extreme, but I had a 25-year-old young woman who, for all intents and purposes, had irritable bowel syndrome. If I would have seen her the first time, I would have made that diagnosis and we would have moved on and started treatment. But she came to me and she had all the classic symptoms. I asked her, so have you ever had a colonoscopy? And she said, yes, I've had 3 normal colonoscopies. And that really has stuck with me since then, because it's really shameful that a 25-year-old person could have had 3 colonoscopies, which are very invasive procedures, not to mention possibility of risk. And the first one was normal. Why would anybody do another normal test and another normal test? And then that expense ratchets up. And some patients have even said they've spent up to $20,000 out of pocket in copay just in the lead up to finally feeling like they have a diagnosis. But irritable bowel syndrome is what we're talking about here. And you're saying, well, what does that have to do with SIBO? So we're going to get into that.
Are you still sharing your screen? Because I can't see it anymore.
It says sharing, yes.
Okay, can you guys see it and I just happen not to be able to?
Can you?
You guys can see his screen, right? We get Kelly, yes? Yep, they can see it. Keep going, you're doing great.
Okay. All right, perfect. So great. I just want to make sure that that we're all good.
Yep.
Chandrima? Can you hold that? All right, so IBS and stress. So before we march into that direction of what is SIBO and how does it fit into IBS, there's been this notion, and it starts with medicine. Medicine has this ability of saying, if we don't understand what's going on, let's chalk it up to stress, because we want to help the patient, we want to do the best for the patient, and if medicine hasn't figured it out, maybe it is stress. And so for the longest time, IBS was linked to psychological trauma or stress in the history of the patient. But it's actually been shown that that's not the case. This was a military trial, deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. And if you shot a gun in combat, shot another human, witnessed human death and suffering, active combat, injured in combat, those were all studied through the deployment. Now remember, they were studied before and after deployment. After deployment, they were coming back with IBS essentially. But none of these sort of stressful events, so the person sitting at a desk at base camp who didn't have as much stress, compared to the active military personnel who would experience these life-threatening situations, no difference in terms of the development of IBS. The only thing that was different was food poisoning predicted the development of IBS in this population. So if you were food poisoned or you had salmonella or shigella or E. coli or something like that during your deployment, that was what predicted the development of IBS. And this is really important because this tells us not that stress doesn't cause IBS, but it tells us that even though they had stress, they didn't develop IBS. It's actually the opposite. They didn't get IBS from stress. All right, so what is SIBO? So now we're sort of flipping, but I'm gonna try and put it all in context. SIBO is, if you look at the colon contains a tremendous amount of stool. The colon is, as the arrow indicates, this sort of larger or the large intestine on the outer perimeter of the abdominal cavity. And then all the wiggly stuff in the middle is the small intestine. Now remember, there's 15 feet of small intestine, 3 to 5 feet of large intestine. So the small intestine really is taking up most of the space. But half the weight of stool is bacteria. But in the small bowel, there's only 10 to the 3, a very small amount of bacteria. That's like 1,000 bacteria for every milliliter. Whereas if you look at 10 to the 12, it's billions and billions of bacteria. So how are these things intertwined? I don't know how much the audience knows about Helicobacter pylori as a cause of ulcers, but it's a similar scenario. Think of ulcers as, let's say you had 100 ulcer patients in your clinic. H. pylori, that bacteria, probably caused 70 of the 100, 70%, 60%, 70%. But the other 30% are caused by other things. Maybe you were taking too much aspirin, or maybe you were taking some medication that was causing ulcers. So not all ulcers are caused by H. pylori, but the majority are, and that's the cause. So the same thing here, IBS is a term we use for a constellation of symptoms, but SIBO accounts for IBS in about 60 or 70%, so it's almost exactly the same scenario. So they're intertwined in a sense, and you'll start to understand this as this is unraveled and revealed to you. But there are also other conditions that are associated with SIBO, so you've got to be mindful of this. So if somebody with SIBO comes in, yes, the majority of them are IBS types of SIBO, but scar tissue or adhesions can cause it, pseudo-obstruction can cause it, narcotics. If you're on morphine or opiates for 2 weeks, you're going to have SIBO. That's been studied back in the 1990s, diabetes or end-stage diabetes, Ehlers-Danlos, and all these other things can cause SIBO as well. But IBS is broken down into three parts. Now we're jumping back and forth, but you'll get this. IBS-C, which is constipation, irritable bowel syndrome mixed, which is M, and then IBS-D, which is the diarrhea component. But the physiology, again, this will be clearer as we progress as well, is that really it's two conditions. It's the IBS-C and then the rest of the group. Because of the antibodies that we're gonna talk about later and the autoimmunity linked to the blue circle here, but not as much clearly linked to the constipation or the red crescent on the left. So this is sort of the spoiler slide, but it's really sort of meant as a template of what I'm going to describe to you, and that is, we start now, we know food poisoning is the cause of IBS in a large proportion of cases, and that this toxin CDTB and the autoimmunity that we're gonna talk about leads to changes in the nerve function of the gut, leads to bacterial buildup, leads to IBS. You could call that post-infectious IBS, which is another terminology you will read about or see on the internet. But it, in essence, post-infectious IBS is IBS. It's just if you can secure that it is from food poisoning, you can give it that nomenclature or that name. We're going to focus on the right first briefly. A lot of these things we've talked about before, but we have some additional pieces of information that I want to share with you. This is an old meta-analysis that I've shown many times, but it basically illustrates that if your IBS, your chance of having a positive breath test, is much higher than if you're healthy. So the single center line that goes all the way down to the number one at the bottom, anything to the right of that means that the study was statistically significant. And that the odds ratio of you having an abnormal breath test if you're IBS is 9.6. So that 9.6 times higher chance that your breath test is positive, which is a huge number and very, very prominent. So that's what we were seeing, that the breath tests were positive. But people were arguing, well, the breath test, maybe it's the sugars getting into the colon quicker. Maybe the transit's fast. Maybe it's not bacterial overgrowth. Maybe it's something else. But I can tell you, for a number of reasons, this is all going to become clear this year. But breath testing is the staple of what we do and how we diagnose bacterial overgrowth in IBS or in any other condition. And so this is what breath testing looks like. So this is the human digestive tract, and the lungs are included there because that's where the breath comes out. But basically, you ingest or drink a syrup containing a sugar. And if you drink a sugar that's not absorbed, it will go through and through and through the gut until it reaches bacteria. And then when it reaches bacteria, they will produce gases. They will produce hydrogen, carbon dioxide, methane, and an additional gas, which is sort of the new thing we'll talk about later. But those three gases are what are measured on the current breath test. Carbon dioxide, humans produce, so we can't use that as a marker of bacteria because we don't know if the CO2 is coming from humans or from bacteria. So we measure hydrogen and methane because humans don't produce that. And so those go to the lungs, number three shows up in the lungs, and then out the breath, and we measure the exhaled air for the concentrations of those gases. But as I mentioned, there is a fourth gas, but really it's a third gas because carbon dioxide doesn't separate humans from bacteria. So there's three gases that tell you about bacteria, but it's a very tricky relationship because hydrogen producing bacteria, when we talk about breath tests, we used to say hydrogen breath test. We don't say that anymore. We say lactulose breath test or glucose breath test because hydrogen is not the only gas and may not even be as important as you'll see later. But hydrogen producing bacteria are the fuel for two other groups of organisms. The methane producers, which are not even bacteria, they're archaea, and they produce methane. But look at the numbers. So you take four hydrogens to produce one methane. So that one bug needs four of those molecules of hydrogen to make one molecule of methane. So it's a sink. It's basically siphoning off a lot of hydrogen to make that methane. Hydrogen sulfide producers are the other category. We couldn't, up until recently, measure hydrogen sulfide in the breath. But hydrogen sulfide producers, five hydrogens to make one hydrogen sulfide. All right. So we'll get back to hydrogen sulfide in a moment. But let's continue on the path of diagnosing overgrowth in IBS because we're trying to make the case that IBS, 60 to 70% of IBS is overgrowth. And if you look at this graph, this is from a Swedish study from all the way back in 2007 showing that if you use different cutoffs of bacteria, and you can see the right cutoff is greater than 5,000 bacteria per milliliter, and you can see 43% of IBS patients have that number. And that they have this so-called overgrowth using 5,000 as a cutoff. But if you use 1,000 as a cutoff, which is really the normal range, 60% in this study, 60% of IBS patients were positive. 27%, these are not healthy people. These are people with illness getting a scope. And 27%, so it was highly statistically significant. And some of those patients may have had overgrowth for other reasons because they were ill. They aren't healthy controls. Now, we now are starting to unravel what bugs are part of SIBO. And what I can't tell you today, sorry, is that we are presenting a major podium session at the big GI meeting in June. So can't talk about it because it hasn't happened yet. that where we describe all the bugs that are part of SIBO in a very large study, which I'll show you sort of the nuts and bolts of how this study is done during this lecture. But in this trial from Pilaris, E. coli is a big player, Klebsiella is a big player in SIBO. Now, it doesn't look much different, those bars, but remember the y-axis is a log 10 axis. So when you go from 1 to 2, it's 10 times higher. 2 to 3 is 10 times higher than 2. So that's 100 times higher than 1. So for every incremental rise, it's 10 times more bacteria of that type. So Klebsiella and E. coli are markedly increased. I've shown this before, and it's kind of a messy thing. We have much more glamorous graphs now coming with the new technologies and the new software. But this is sort of a pie chart of what's going on in the small bowel in humans who are normal. A lot of little pies, a lot of different bacteria, but a lot of good balance. In IBS, the balance is thrown off a lot. A lot of Aeromonas, a lot of E. coli, and Klebsiella, which we talked about. But again, we'll have much more granularity on that. So the MAST program, one of the sort of flagship, if you want to call it, studies in the MAST program, this took a long time to get up and running, is the Reimagine study. And this is what we're presenting the first few abstracts of in a very dramatic way at the DDW meeting. The Reimagine study, we feel that the small bowel microbiome, first of all, has not been captured. So we are the only center in the world doing a large-scale small bowel microbiome assessment using the modern techniques of deep sequencing, culture, and the like. But we think the diseases that are related really to the 15 feet long small bowel where you absorb food and nutrients and so forth, that's where things get absorbed. So if you have chemicals that are harmful to you from bacteria, it's going to be absorbed from the small bowel because it's an absorbing surface. So obesity, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, scleroderma, neuromuscular disease, autoimmune disease, even the effects of medications we're studying, hormone metabolism, all of that is part of the Reimagine trial where we hope to get up to 10,000 people. But we have a lot in already and a lot of data already, and we're super excited about presenting that. But this is the kind of stuff we're collecting. We're collecting hormonal analysis, histamines, serotonin, autoimmune markers, immune markers. We're looking at culturing plus the deep sequencing plus all the genetics of the human. So this is a very, very ambitious project that is already bearing fruit. And I wish I could tell you more because the amount of excitement we have about this project and our results already is really amazing. So hopefully you'll hear more as time goes by. But I want to give you one teaser. If you think about this large intestine, half the bacteria in the large intestine, half the weight of stool is bacteria, but half of the bacteria that you find there are dead. They're not even producing anything, but you can still amplify the DNA. So it makes it very difficult to determine what bacteria are important to disease when everything you're measuring, most of what you're measuring is dead. The small intestine is different. What we measure are live bacteria, and we've actually proven that with comparing to culture and other techniques to show that they're alive because there's a lot of nutrients in that environment and other factors. But this is what the large intestine on the left looks like and the small intestine on the right. So one of the, it's not a pet peeve, but it's more of a point of clarification that the Human Microbiome Project, maybe you've heard of this, the Human Microbiome Project was a project that started in the 2000s, but in 2007, the Nature paper was published saying, okay, ta-da, here's the human microbiome, and they used stool as a surrogate of the gut. But as you can see, the graph on the right looks completely different than the graph on the left, and the bacterial composition of the small intestine is completely different than stool. So you cannot say what's in the stool represents what's in the 15 feet of small bowel, the longest segment of the gut. And we're going to illustrate that in real specific and very, very tangible detail in DDW to describe all the organisms of the small bowel and why they're so important and so uniquely different. But one of the things we found way back, shifting gears now to methane, is this is a paper from 2011, still a little old, but it's still relevant today. If we were to repeat this study with all the new data we have, this would be even more impactful and powerful because we now know methane and constipation go together. We also know that if we put methane into the gut, and this was an animal trial, if you put methane into the gut, you get 70% slowing of transit. So methane slows the gut down. Now, it does it in a very unique way. It doesn't paralyze the gut. It actually causes the gut to contract in a way that's not peristaltic, sort of holding things back. And that can be part of the reason why people get cramps, because it actually causes sort of a spasticity of the gut. But the point is that methane slows the gut. And as a result of that, we could actually predict people with constipation just by measuring methane. But I kind of don't like this study, and this is a study that we did, but I don't like it because it suggests that we're using methane to diagnose constipation. I don't want to use methane to diagnose constipation. If a patient's constipated and they have methane, methane's not telling me they're constipated. It's telling me how to treat them, because treating methane is different than treating hydrogen. And we'll talk about that briefly. I've already showed you this just to refresh your memory. But what I wanted to get to is the third gas before we get into treatment. So we developed a device now, and this doesn't look very exciting. It's a box with a computer on it because it was the first prototype. So now the new device is coming. But the first prototype of measuring hydrogen, methane, and hydrogen sulfide all at once. And we actually validated this instrument and this technique at the last meeting of DDW. Basically, I'm going to show you one slide to show you that hydrogen sulfide equals diarrhea. So if you go back to this slide, I'm going back once, now we know hydrogen really doesn't predict anything. So it may predict response to drugs, which I'll show you later, but it doesn't predict symptoms. So for example, we were always struggling with, well, if hydrogen's 100 on the breath test in one patient and 50 on the breath test, that's half on another patient, why do they have exactly the same bloating, the same intensity of diarrhea, and you couldn't predict symptoms with it? Whereas with methane, the more methane you produce, the more constipated you are. The higher it is on the breath test, the more constipated you are. Because hydrogen is just a fuel for the two gases that we think determine the symptoms. Hydrogen sulfide is very toxic to the epithelium, to the lining of the intestine. So hydrogen sulfide, the higher it is, the more diarrhea. So going back to the slide I just showed you, for every 1 ppm, 1 part per million rise in hydrogen sulfide, we saw 15 per point higher severity of diarrhea. So it's proportional. So this acts like methane, but on the opposite side of the equation. So let's talk about treatment, and then we're going to get into this whole post-infectious IBS and autoimmunity, because that's really the most interesting and new stuff. But this is the rifaximin trials. Rifaximin has become the staple treatment for irritable bowel syndrome. It's FDA approved for IBS. It's off-label for SIBO, but it's kind of confusing because SIBO is IBS, because we believe that it's mechanistically related, but your treatment is for irritable bowel syndrome because that's how the patients were enrolled and defined for the trial. But essentially, rifaximin in this study, you take it for 2 weeks and you got 4 weeks in the follow-up period. So 2 weeks of treatment, 4 weeks of follow-up right after that. And everything to the right of that center line, again, that goes down to one, means that it was statistically significant. And everything was statistically significant, whether it was pain, the global symptoms, the new very challenging FDA endpoint, and so forth. But even the next slide, 3 months later, almost everything was still statistically significant. So for the first time, there was a drug that did something to IBS patients. You could say permanently meaning you weren't on drug and you were still getting the effect of the drug many, many, many weeks later. And so the point is, it must have impacted a causative factor in IBS. And we believe that causative factor is the microbiome and SIBO, at least in my opinion. So now what's amazing about rifaximin is we've studied this now, and this is published. This is in Digestive Diseases and Sciences now. It's no longer an ACG meeting. But what's amazing about it is over a decade, now it's been off-label use, and then of course it got approved in 2015. So it was used for IBS off-label. But there's been a 30% reduction in patients coming to my office, coming to even GI offices now over this period of time, because patients are using it at lower levels of care now, which saves money, saves the headache for the patient, means the patients are running around less. And so rifaximin has made a dent in IBS for a first time like no other. And there's a 2.5% increase in rifaximin use over that same period of time. So I was going to tell you that even though I've sort of said hydrogen is a fuel, it is a predictor. So in this study, which was presented at ACG and is now papers developed and going to be submitted for publication in the coming days or weeks. But basically, if you look at the rifaximin study, 44% of people respond to rifaximin. That's the first bar. But if your breath test was negative in the study, only 25% responded. So yeah, you still can respond, but only a quarter of people can respond if the breath test is negative for hydrogen. But if the breath test was positive, 56% responded. So that was much higher. If the breath test was positive and rifaximin made it negative, 76% of people met the FDA endpoint, which was a tricky endpoint. And so this is very meaningful, meaning that the breath test was detecting a surrogate marker. Okay, so this is now treating methane. Look at the middle bar, because it's the rifaximin bar. Made a big deal about rifaximin on the previous page, but rifaximin doesn't work for methane. Neomycin, you could argue on that run the red bars, maybe works slightly better than rifaximin, even though that's an older product. But what we knew from studying the methane producing organism in test tubes is that if you combine rifaximin and neomycin together, you've got a much better eradication of the bug. And we don't understand why, because when we developed antibiotics, antibiotics were designed for bacteria. They weren't designed for fungi, for example. They weren't designed for archaea. Archaea are methanogens. So on the right bar is a methanogen, but yet it's responding to the two antibiotics. So there must be some way that it's affecting them. Anyway, look at the yellow bar, the clinical response, greater than 80% improvement in constipation, meeting the constipation result point. And so this was a really robust effect. However, the problem with giving rifaximin and neomycin, I'll show you in the coming slides. We then did a double blind study where we took real drug, neomycin alone, with placebo and compared it to neomycin plus rifaximin. And you can see that neomycin rifaximin superior in this double-blind study in treating constipation. Bloating also got better. But this is the point. The point is, it's not about the antibiotics. It's about getting the methane less than 3. When we got the methane less than 3, that's the patient who did best. And the problem with the response that I showed you here with bloating and with constipation is they tended to last about a month on average. So it's not like the rifaximin story for IBS-D and I have had patients in my clinic, I treat them, I don't see them for 2 years, they're still better, and then maybe they relapse 2.5 years later. Some people, of course, relapse at 1 month and 2 months, but we can have patients who relapse very late. With methane, it's a little different. It relapses more easily, meaning it's a sooner relapse, but it could be the nature of the organism. It could be that these are antibiotics designed for bacteria, not for methanogens. So we had to come up with something better. So Syn-10, I know a lot of the audience has heard about this because I get a ton of emails and comments, when is this coming? So let me tell you the story and tell you when it's coming. But it's lovastatin. Now lovastatin is produced by this fungus on the screen, which is Aspergillus. And the little vesicles produce this lovastatin. And the lovastatin is produced not for human cholesterol, but in fact for the environment in which this fungus lives. And it inhibits methane. And that's what lovastatin does. And in a first study we did where we took this lovastatin, now by the way, people say, well, what about Crestor, or excuse me for using trade names, but some of the atorvastatin and other statins, could it work? Turns out that every time a human has tampered with the molecule lovastatin in order to make it better for human cholesterol, it has destroyed what nature created to inhibit methane. So you can't use the more modern ones. Plus, the lovastatin is designed to be absorbed for cholesterol. So this product here is a delivery system for lovastatin that makes sure it doesn't get absorbed. So there's literally very little that gets into your bloodstream, so your cholesterol would not be impacted. Back to the story. So if you look here, I'll show you the methane in a second, but the red bar or dots are the use of laxatives as rescue. And what you can see is that the patients on the highest dose are using far less laxatives than the green bar or green dots where they're using placebo. They need a lot of laxatives because their constipation is bad. And on that basis, we've started the phase two trial. It's 150 patients, only Cedars-Sinai. I'm sorry that if you're in other parts of the country, people less than 65 years old have to have constipation, and it's a three-month trial. Good news is it's not a placebo drug trial. It's a placebo drug trial. So there's three arms, which means there's a 67% chance you get real drug as opposed to placebo. Some studies it's 50-50. And so I know people are always worried they're going to get in a trial and get placebo. At least the odds are higher. But we're really excited. This is launched. We have a huge lineup of people for this trial because it's very exciting and a lot of people are still suffering with this condition and their methane. All right, so now we're going to work on the left side of the screen in the last sort of half of the talk. Acute gastroenteritis can be caused by E. coli, Campylobacter, Shigella, Salmonella. These are names you've probably heard when you hear about an outbreak at a particular restaurant. And so those things can lead to IBS ultimately or overgrowth. And there's a toxin that they all produce commonly. And interestingly, this is really one of the only toxins they all produce commonly. And so we had to find something in common with those organisms and why any of them can portend the development of SIBO. So what I'm going to do is focus on this side of the screen. Now, so I don't know if there's any doctors on the call or listening in, but as a clinician, as a doctor in 2019, this is a study from 2017, but now I'm saying 2 years later after this trial, if there's a doctor that doesn't know about post-infectious IBS and that IBS is post-infectious in the majority of cases, it's a concern, because this trial from the Mayo Clinic looked at 45 outbreaks, the published studies of 45 outbreaks in the world, and showed without a doubt definitively that if you get food poisoning, you have an 11% chance, 11% of people who were exposed to food poisoning go on to develop IBS because of seeing that infection. Full stop. Food poisoning causes IBS. So it's really important to know this, because let's think about inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis. We still, with all the money from the NIH and all the money out there for IBD, speaking of, there's no money from the NIH for IBS. Despite that, we know more about the development of IBS now because of this, because of knowing food poisoning is the starting point. We now know more about the development of IBS than we do Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. So that's very meaningful change in this condition. And you know, the people who don't know about this in terms of medical practitioners really need to pay attention to this new area. Turns out there are risk factors, but it's all about that first bullet. The severity of the food poisoning, I should put it all in caps, because if you had blood in the stool, if you needed antibiotics, if you were fever, had to be admitted to hospital, all of those things mean it's not 11% for you, maybe it's 20% for you, chance of developing IBS. The sicker you were, the more likely you are to develop IBS from it. Psychological factors play a role, but I want to focus really, women are more likely to develop IBS from food poisoning. So if you took 100 men and 100 women, food poisoning, the women are more likely, almost every trial, women are more likely to get IBS from that. So how does that happen? And I will try to address that a little bit as we move to the final slides. But this is an interesting study, because we said, well, how much of IBS do we think could have been food poisoning? So this was a model where we took 300 million people, approximate population of the US, and we said, okay, let's bring 300 people into the US. Right today, nobody has IBS, zero. And looking at the Center for Disease Control rates of food poisoning in the population, and then created a model, we found that after about 12 years, 9% of the entire 300 million would now have IBS based on everything we knew at the time. And so this suggests, remember, IBS is about 12 to 15% of the population. This suggests that at least 60 to 70% of the IBS population could have been derived from food poisoning. Again, that's where these are the evidence for suggesting that 60 to 70% of IBS is SIBO, 60 to 70% of food is food poisoning related based on data like this. I've showed these slides before, but they become more and more meaningful with time as we start to unravel the autoimmune part of this. So we wanted to show what happens. Could we create rats with IBS? So rats on the left got no Campylobacter. Rats on the right got Campylobacter infection, recovered. And then 3 months after that, meaning 3 months of no campy, no more campy in the stool, and they just sit around, we were then able to look at their stool consistency and see if they had like weird bowel function, and then see if they had bacterial overgrowth by qPCR, which is a really sophisticated technique, at least at the time, to see and quantitate bacteria. And what we found was 27, focus on the right, 27% of the rats who saw Campylobacter now have SIBO. But that SIBO, looking at the pink bar, if they had Campylobacter and SIBO, 80%+ of them had weird bowel function. So we had, for the first time, a model of animals that had bacterial overgrowth, post-infectious IBS, all wrapped up into one. Why is this important? It's important because in 2008 to now, we've been able to study this model to figure out the steps and the nuts and bolts of why this is happening. And when you understand why this is happening, you understand how to treat it ultimately in the end. And that's what we're doing. So back to the toxin. So we know Shigella, Salmonella, Campylobacter, even C. difficile, for those of you who've had C. diff in the past, can cause IBS, but also share this one toxin, cytolethal distending toxin. And this toxin is a culprit here, but it isn't what we thought. So let's walk through the studies. On the left, rats got the regular campy that causes the IBS. In the middle, the rats got a Campylobacter that was missing the toxin. We deleted the toxin from the bug, so it couldn't produce CDTB. On the right is mimicking you going and you're going to a food truck that you know has Campylobacter, and you're taking rifaximin the day before, the day of the campy, and the day after. So you're trying to prevent the campy from making you have IBS. And sure enough, the rats who got rifaximin, they had the best stool consistency. One is normal. The rats with CDTB in them got the most, and the rats without CDTB were mitigated. The point is CDTB was implicated. So we were for the first time, we said, okay, we have a factor in the bacteria that we think is causing this. So we then took tissue, and so I know this is hard to explain, it's a lot of science, but look on the left. This is just rabbit antibodies. They don't bind anything. It's all blank. We put rabbit antibodies on the left, but it's all clean, no brown staining. On the right, we developed rabbits who have antibodies to CDTB. And we took those that CDTB antibody, put it on there, and the nerves of the gut all light up. So you can see the ganglia are pointed out, and the DMPICC is a very complicated name. But those cells are what make the migrating motor complex, or the cleaning wave of the small intestine, and it's that wave that, when missing, causes bacterial overgrowth. So those cells are pacemaker cells for that wave, which I will show you right here. This wave is super important to clean up during fasting, during the nighttime, when you're not eating, and you hear a gurgling sound in your stomach. It's cleaning. It's cleaning up like a dishwasher would clean your dishes at the end of the day. And then the small bowel is beautifully clean for the morning when you start breakfast. If you're missing those brown little cells, DMPICCs, or they're reduced, this doesn't happen often enough, and then you can get overgrowth. This is part of the mechanism. But it turns out, going back to this slide, that the antibodies to CDTB caused this brown staining even in the rats who never saw Campylobacter. So we now knew that something in this antibody is, or reacting to CDTB, was causing you to react to you and the nerves that are you. And so we knew that it was some, what we call molecular mimicry. The toxin was looking like something that is you, creating an antibody to you, and as a result, autoimmune disease. So we wanted to prove that in this way. So we said, well, let's take the Campylobacter. Let's suck out the CDTB and purify it. So now we're going to give to the rats, like a vaccine in the arm, in their back leg, we put CDTB only. No campy, no infection, no food truck, no nothing, and then see what happens to them. Well, they develop antibodies to CDTB like crazy because we put CDTB in, but they also develop antibodies to themselves, the anti-vinculin antibodies that we'll talk about here in a moment. So what is vinculin? We're going to talk about that, but look, one more thing. So, because this is probably the more important thing, is these rats, just from getting CDTB injected into them, and the level of the anti-CDTB antibody predicted the development of increased numbers of bacteria in the gut, duodenum and ileum, and a decreased expression of vinculin. So, and a change in the stool wet weight. So basically, we were creating IBS just with seeing this toxin. So what is vinculin? So these are cells in a very beautifully depicted fluorescent staining from our lab. But if you look at the red arrows, they're pointing to these tufts. I don't know if you can see my arrow. If you can't, I'm sorry. But there's little red tufts at the end, and that's vinculin. And the green are the filaments or the skeleton of the cell. So you can see that these red areas are reaching out to grab onto the next cell so that the nerves and the wires of the nerves are connected to each other. This is another depiction. So this is actin. This is the green in the previous slide. And this is vinculin over here. It's part of like a motor that makes the cell move along the actin to create these sort of little tendrils or fingers out to grab onto the next cell. So what we were seeing in the humans was you get CDTB, you get food poisoning, you form antibodies to this CDTB, and you form it to a lot of the CDTB because you don't know it. It's just like a foreign chemical. So you're reacting to it. But one of these areas has a similarity to vinculin, and you develop this vinculin antibody. So we developed a test to measure anti-vinculin and anti-CDTB in humans, and could it diagnose IBS specifically as caused by food poisoning? And we compared it to Crohn's, ulcerative colitis, and celiac, as well as healthy controls. But in the end, the test worked like this. So you, in a GI office, so we're modeling a GI office, there's a 56% chance before you even see the patient that it could be IBS because it's so common. And if one test was positive or two tests were positive, you have a 95% chance that it's IBS. So it was very diagnostic, very what we call post-test probability was very high. If both tests were negative, it drops to 24%. But the sensitivity and specificity of the test needed improvement. So we've actually launched a new test that is second generation because there were some issues that we detected along the way that we could improve to make the epitopes more exposed in the dishes so we could actually see the intensity of attachment much, much better. So now the specificity for both markers is more than 90%, and now we get to 98% certain, and this will save a ton of money because imagine that patient, that 25-year-old woman I mentioned at the beginning, if she simply had a test, it was positive, you don't need colonoscopies because the certainty is 98%. The specificity for either marker alone is 90%. So it stops the unnecessary testing. This is an animal study, just taking it a step further. This is new data. Siobhan says new data, new data, new data. So we injected these antibodies into these animals, and they're alive. And then we were able to see that the antibodies go to the gut. And the gut of these antibodies is on the right, and you can see the antibodies are right in the gut. And the small intestine's at the top, so it's attacking if you want to say it that way. But we can see the antibodies glowing in that section just from injecting it in the blood. These are some clinical observations we've made, not published yet, but more interesting things. Higher anti-vinculin antibodies means greater bloating and distension. We see some of the worst bloaters have the highest levels of vinculin, and also makes, we think, the SIBO more difficult to treat. So some of the patients who take an antibiotic, doesn't work. We're seeing that these antibodies are super high. I know that doesn't help some of you in the sense that, but what do I do? How do I still get rid of the overgrowth if I have these high antibodies? But it at least for the moment explains why you're tougher than somebody else. These antibodies also work in mixed. So they work in D and mixed, but not as much in CIBS, and this was published about a year and a half ago. So I want to show you a new thing again, as something I haven't shown on a slide. And this is a patient. So just to show you how these antibodies work, got gastroenteritis, was traveling to Mexico. And then after the gastroenteritis, ended up in the hospital here in the US, just coming back from the trip, and now had severe bloating and IBS. And this was how the CDTB response and antivinculin response work. And it doesn't show up, that's so weird. Okay, so I'm gonna describe it. So initially, the anti-CDTB goes way up and then drifts down over time, over months. The antivinculin comes in later. So about 2 or 3 months later, the antivinculin antibody starts to rise and stays up. Because remember, once the CDTB is gone, the infection is gone, you don't have any more CDTB around. So the CDTB antibody starts to drift down. The vinculin, though, you have it in your body. And so you can continue to form it, which makes the autoimmunity more potent at keeping you impaired. And for Siobhan, I'm sorry if this one doesn't, the graph doesn't come in. I can send you that slide if you want to share it with your audience. Okay. So really complicated. I think you're going to see the deck so you can like read through this very slowly, but this is how we think it works. If both antibodies are negative, we don't think food poisoning was the cause of the IBS or SIBO for you. If anti-CDTB is high and vinculin is low, it diagnoses IBS. It may mean the infection was recent or that you don't have a tendency to form as much autoimmunity. If the CDTB is low and the vinculin is high, it could have been that the infection was a long time ago, but you still have this antibody that's hurting you. If both are high, it could be recent infections coming and going, and I'll show you why that's important. And so this is starting to explain how the two antibodies work in tandem. But if the vinculin's very high, and we've seen this in these pseudo-obstruction patients, we think it portends a neuropathy. Because if you go back to the rat study way back, the higher the antibodies were, the sicker or more overgrowth the rats had. And so we are believe, and the less the vinculin was. So we think that it's actually more damage with higher titers of these antibodies. I'm going to show you something just because, but you're not going to do this. Promise you're not going to do this because I know there are people out there willing to do anything for their overgrowth, but I want to show you this. This is a case series. This is not a published study. We're kind of reluctant to publish this only because it's a small number, but it tells me an important fact, okay? So these are people that we put in here that are extraordinary, okay? They're extraordinarily bloated, and I don't want you to go out and do this, but they were so severe, they were in and out of hospital. They had very high anti-vinculin antibodies, and we then filtered those antibodies out, almost like dialysis, called plasmapheresis. With the filtering of those antibodies, of course, the antibodies were gone, but the patient felt the best she had in years. No bloating, no distension, bowel movements became completely normal. But a month later, 2 months later, the antibodies come back because we haven't gotten rid of the cells that produce the antibody. And of course, they're rebringing the antibodies back into the bloodstream. My point is, we know that the vinculin is critical. And if we can get rid of it, we think we can make a huge impact on patients. And so the reason for this slide is to tell you we're hot on this. We want to fix this, but plasmapheresis is not the answer because it's very, it filters all antibodies. It makes you immunodeficient. So you don't want to do this at home. It's a proof that this is a potential mechanism for understanding vinculin as a cause. Okay. So patient's perspective. Finally, I know what I have. I hear this all the time. That's why we like doing this testing. Less testing. Once the test is positive, you don't need to do anything more. You're diagnosed in a few handful of days. Sooner diagnosis means less cost, because if you're not running around doctor to doctor getting test after test after test, you're going to save money for yourself, for your health, for the healthcare system, and frustration as well. Patients know it's food poisoning. So now you know why you have what you have, and it's not in your head. It's an organic marker. And need to risk counsel. So I'm going to talk about this risk counseling. So I'm going to skip five because this is super important for the last few slides of my deck. And you can potentially follow people in time. We already showed a time study. The slide didn't work properly, which I'll send to Siobhan, but over time, if the antibodies can be brought down or they go down, we think that's a good sign. So if a year from now, the vinculin comes down further, you know you're heading in the right direction. And eventually, maybe your IBS goes away if you never get food poisoning again. And we think this is the template for future therapies. So back to this, because I have one last teaser for you. And that is IBS, is it, because of all this damage, a risk for food poisoning? So did Campylobacter give you this toxin, make you have this autoimmunity so that every time you're exposed to food that's slightly off, you're more likely to get food poisoning than somebody without IBS? And the answer is yes. So let's talk about Campylobacter just briefly. It's a major scourge. It's one of the leading causes of death in children under the age of 2. And I'll speak to that momentarily. But this is the study. I spoke to my colleagues in the military. I said, well, what if you already have IBS and then you get deployed? Do you have a higher chance of food poisoning? So you're basically already damaged. And does that mean you're going to get sick easier than somebody else if you have food that's not right? So IBS patient going to deployment, 2.9 times higher. So yes, if you have IBS, you're more likely to get sick when you travel. You're also more likely to jack those antibodies higher, which means it's harder for the doctors to treat you if you get food poisoning again. And we've seen antibodies jump up with people who get food poisoning a second time. One last thing, and then I'm done, and we'll go to questions. So obviously the world is different in different parts. Underdeveloped areas have tremendous difficulties with sanitation, clean water, and the exposure to these pathogens. I'm going to tease you with some information, but we're working with a group that's working in Tanzania with the Gates Foundation. And these people in these environments where the poverty is so terrible that they don't get clean drinking water, they get acute gastroenteritis. And the children here, imagine Campylobacter. Most people in Western world don't see Campylobacter till Club Med. These children under the age of 1, in fact, the statistic is that by age 6 months to a year, 60% of children in these areas have seen Campylobacter or have been infected with Campylobacter. So they also seroconvert, and they get an autoimmune enteropathy, essentially, is what we think. So this distension that this young boy has who's been exposed to this malnutrition may not be all that it appears, because their bowels actually distended and almost like pseudo-obstruction. And we, in the underdeveloped countries, it is called bacterial overgrowth, which is related to what we call tropical sprue, chronic distension, vitamin deficiencies. Some of them even die from the malnutrition. But they are also the spreader of the infection, because if they're the one that keeps getting infected because the way their gut functions, they're harnessing or harboring these pathogens because of what the bug did to them. So it actually keeps the bug in the population. We can't fix this. This is a political problem. Maybe we can fix these things, and I'll speak to that just briefly, maybe immunize. So this is one of the things that I want to show you, is that we've looked at the vinculin antibody, and in malnutrition, the vinculin antibodies are through the roof. So these young children who are quite malnourished, exposed to pathogens, we think it's really important in the underdeveloped country as well. And so it's just an extension of the most extreme examples of what these organisms can do to people. What we're trying to figure out is, how do we get an vaccine developed that we can prevent the autoimmunity and protect against getting CDTB? And we have really good signals on where that is, and we're getting at it. So in summary, the diagnostic part, RUM criteria, which is the diagnostic test for IBS, which is just clinical criteria, really aren't very good, but easy and available, but they really don't tell you about pathophysiology. There used to be some genetic testing, which wasn't very helpful. Fecal calprotectin can be helpful, but it's really, if you're positive, you have inflammation. Maybe you have Crohn's, but if you're negative, it doesn't tell you you have IBS. The breath test is helpful. Specificity is somewhat low, but you'll see some data at DDW that maybe speaks to that. But the blood test, easy to get, it's available, high specificity. it makes IBS a diagnosis of inclusion. You now have it. It's based on the pathophysiology, which I've convinced you of, hopefully. It tells you therapy because it tells you, it's going to tell us how we're going to end up treating these patients, and it reduces costs. So my final slide is most of IBS appears related to SIBO. Vinculin, it's an adhesion complex protein, appears to be super important in this whole process because antibodies to vinculin can damage the nerves of the gut, and that's gaining in importance. Hydrogen sulfide is going to be key to understanding the diarrhea and perhaps guiding treatment until we figure out how to get rid of vinculin. And methane is associated with constipation, and we're very optimistic that Syn-10 is going to be the microbiome-based approach to treat methane. And so just to show you this in outline, remember, everything we're doing is very systematic. I've showed you this picture, but we're developing a vaccine here. We're developing the blood tests, which I've showed you here. We're developing preventive therapies. Those are prokinetics. That's why we use prokinetics, because we want to improve the neuropathy. The neuropathy is there, but some of the wires are connected and we make them work better. We're developing new breath tests, hydrogen sulfide breath tests, and new therapies. Of course, rifaximin is one of them, but the future may have others, and I already know of others that were in the works. And that's, this is our team working for you all out there, and they don't always smile this broadly, but because we work them very hard, but they're a very cohesive team. They enjoy working with each other, and I certainly enjoy them as well. And that's the talk, folks.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
How did I do for time?
You did great. You did absolutely brilliantly. Thank you so much.